This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. When I went on my last holiday to Cape Town, it was amazing. My friends were there, the weather was phenomenal, and most importantly, the food was fantastic. But one thing I struggled with was finding the right places to stay. You know, all I want is a great bed, a fantastic shower, and breakfast that doesn't end at 8 a.m. I'm on holiday, I'm still sleeping. I also like ease, and the Hotels.com app easily helps me to find a perfect hotel for every trip. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly getaway or a relaxing spa weekend, on the Hotels.com app, you can compare up to 5 hotels side by side. Now, why would you want to do that? So you can see prices, amenities, and star ratings. And best of all, you don't have to switch back and forth between options. See? Ease. So, start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app today.
Hello and welcome to Out to Lunch, the podcast where I get to chat to the most fabulous guests and feed them some delicious food. Not literally, of course, as we're still in lockdown. This series, myself and my guests are sat in our respective homes and I order in a surprise takeaway for us to share virtually over a video link. Today, that special delivery is going to the home of former Labour Cabinet Minister and Strictly star, Ed Balls.
She said, I know what we'll do. She went to the kitchen, came back in with 20 small glasses and a bottle of Harvey's Bristol Cream. And she poured everybody at 9 in the morning a small glass of sherry. And they all toasted my demise.
Hello, Ed, and welcome for In for Lunch. There is a Deliveroo driver. I can see the little icon moving across my phone, heading towards you from Green Lanes, which you're just off, with a load of Green Lanes' finest. And I suspect you know exactly what that means.
Green Lanes, it's got to be Turkish.
It has got to be Turkish. So you've got Turkish food heading towards you from a very well-known Turkish restaurant there called Diyarbakir. And I've got almost exactly the same menu coming from a place called Saray here in Herne Hill.
The truth is, I've never ever had it for lunch.
Have you not?
Normally, about 2 in the morning for the Strictly after party, we used to go to one of those different Turkish restaurants on Green Lanes because they're open till like 4 or 5 in the morning and they're like a hub of activity. So, and it's a brilliant time to eat late night Turkish.
Excellent stuff. I mean, I'm loving this. The image of you being, you know, forced to eat Turkish food at lunchtime. But then, you know, these are extraordinary circumstances. But tell me the story about your lasagna.
The history of the lasagna, after the election 2010, I became Shadow Chancellor. We were back in opposition. I was having a dinner for my team, ministers and the whips and our advisors, about 20 people. And Yvette said, I'd done it once before, could she invite her team as well? Because I was going to cook lasagna and so it'd be about 30 people, 35 people. The Mail on Sunday then had a big double paid spread, Ed and Yvette's lasagna plot. Which was that we had deliberately had a lasagna evening in order to cabal against Ed Miliband's leadership and attempt to depose him. And for some reason, the lasagna was kind of central to, and it wasn't like a spaghetti bolognese evening or a barbecue evening. It was the lasagna plot. Then a couple of months later, somebody got in touch. So they were doing a fundraiser. Would I cook a lasagna, or at least, you know, put the lasagna together, which they could auction as one of Ed's lasagnas, as in of the plot? And I said, sure. And I think it
you
went
said
the
yes.
first one went like, yeah. So I did it, and it went for £1,000. I wrote out on a piece of House of Commons paper the recipe, put it on the top. I must have done that since, I don't know, 15, 20 times. I think one went for £8,000.
That's a very valuable lasagna. Amazing. Has Ed Miliband ever eaten your lasagna, the plot lasagna?
I'm not sure that Ed Miliband has ever eaten my lasagna. He did have, though, once a dinner for the Shadow Cabinet. He had kind of dinner for Shadow Cabinet members in his office, you know, once every few months. But there was one period where he was clearly on one of those no-carb evening diets. And his office coordinated poorly and decided to serve us all lasagna. And Ed was attempting to draw the shadow cabinet together and rally us for the fight ahead. And all that any of us could focus on was the fact that he spent the whole of the meal picking out the sheets of lasagna from his lasagna, putting them to one side and only to eat the rest of it. And it's kind of, it was so meticulous. I mean, they should have had chili.
Your doorbell is about to go. I would go to your front door and collect your food. I'm looking at the map. It's right there.
There it goes. That was the doorbell.
Go get it all. You might need some cutlery. Now, shall I tell you what you have been sent by Diyarbakir, what should be there? You should have three separate things. So there's two parts to the savoury side. So you've got a mini mezze platter, which should have hummus, kisia, which is a couscous salad, a beetroot dip, havuk tarator, which is yogurt with carrot and dill and onion and garlic, and baba ganoush, obviously aubergine, and I always mispronounce this, muhammara, red peppers with chilies and walnuts. So there's a whole lot of mezze there.
They certainly think they're not just catering for one. You either think it's their family meal or you've definitely overordered.
Is there any way you could hold it up to the camera so we can just... Oh, wow, look at that.
Has yours arrived yet?
So I have received a rather large bag of... Basically, I've got the same as you. So I think we should both hit our mezze. Well, mine's
good.
Mine's enormous as well. There's a lot going on. I'm going to, just so you can see if I can hold it up. It's the same sort of thing.
Oh, look at that.
I love the way you're leaning over as though you're peering into...
I know. I sort of feel as though if I...
An open drawer.
Exactly. I can lean in and see down.
Do you accept that people might, a few years ago, have found this hinterland of yours, this interest in lasagna recipes? And we'll get on. There's a piano I can see in our Zoom behind you. And obviously, you know, the two of us share this interest. That the Ed Balls, who was in the shadow cabinet, obviously in government before that, they wouldn't necessarily have associated all of that with you. You seem too head down and straightforward and all about the policy.
I think that being a cabinet minister, particularly shadow cabinet minister to some extent, I mean, it's hard and consuming. And so it's not so easy to have the time to do the kind of things you might want to do in an everyday life. But I think there's a bigger issue, which is that the nature of politics means that things are seen through a prism. People find it very hard to look through that and see the real you. What they see is the image which is refracted through. And that's quite constructed by your job, how the opposition sees you, how the press report you. And, you know, I think if I'd been shorter and thinner, I might have had a different image. But, you know, the nature of me was always that I was going to be seen as a bit of a bruiser. And then government's tough and sometimes there's arguments and rows. And if you fight your corner, then that adds to the image. And then when you are having big arguments, as we were with David Cameron and George Osborne, across the dispatch box, head to head, then that all feeds the image. And the truth was, I was doing all the things I do now, I've always done. So I don't think I fundamentally changed. I think most people who really know me would say I'm the same as I was 5, 10 and 15 years ago. But one of the funny things for me after Strictly, I mean, all the time people say, they still do, if I get in a taxi, a cab driver will say, "We always knew you were a politician, but it's really nice to find out that now you're a human being."
So can I take you back to Norwich, where you grew up?
Yep.
I read your book. You got a little bit of stick because some people suggested that you emphasised your grandfather's working class background without necessarily talking about your dad having become a professor. But and what kind of an upbringing was it, would you say?
Comfortable. There was not a lot of money. I didn't go abroad until I was 18. Didn't go on an aeroplane until I went to graduate school at age 21. So there wasn't foreign holidays or fancy cars. But we never went without. So we were fine, but we weren't flush.
And football, I have to say, I have no interest in football. But it was clearly, what's really striking about the way you wrote about it in your book is less about sport and more about tribe.
We moved from Norwich when I was 8 to Nottingham, but I came from Norwich and I was a Norwich City supporter, and that was like a big deal for me with all these
At that time, Nottingham Forest was a very big team. I mean, it's obviously still important, but it was a very
Brian
big team.
Brian Clough was winning the European Cup and the First Division Championship, but we saw Norwich at Leicester and Derby and Nottingham, but also when we went back to Norwich to see family, and my mum and dad both had big families in Norfolk, the football was always a part of that, going to games, listening on the radio during kind of weddings and christenings. And then over time, I don't think my dad ever talked much about this when we were little. His father died when he was 10. And this was, I think, a big searing experience in his life. And he was the youngest of three boys and his mother never worked. And so they genuinely were living on welfare support, went to the grammar school and then went to university. But it turned out, my dad told me later, that his father worked in Norwich in the gas company on Gas Hill and then would walk down the hill at lunchtime and then would work on the turnstiles in the afternoon at the football ground at Carrow Road. And when his two sons arrived age 8, 9, he would lift them over the turnstiles so they could go and watch the game while he was working. And he would then go and work on the speedway in the evening. So actually, I came to realise later how much the football club and its binding nature in our family is carrying on something which was there 50, 60, 70 years ago for my father.
By the way, how is the Meze? Is it all right?
It's really good. My own disappointment is I'd quite like the Muska Borek. Do you know
which one's that?
Muska Borek is the feta cheese in the phyllo pastry, which folds over into a triangle.
Yeah, it basically, blame me, it was definitely on the menu and I didn't order it for you. So I've let you down, Ed. I've not done a good job. So you're a teenager, 14, 15. Had politics become part of the idea? Were you thinking, when I grow up, what I really want to be is Chancellor of the Exchequer? Or was there some other thought in your head?
There was definitely a period when I wanted to play for Norwich, but that...
good luck with that.
Didn't quite work out. And although I didn't really ever give that up until about 4 or 5 years ago, I always had in this mind, in my mind, I always believed that it was possible there might be a Tannoy announcement.
Did you?
No, we're short. We need a volunteer and it might be me. However, I wanted to be a politician, or at least I wanted to be part of making economic policy. This was 1983, 84, 85. I had a brilliantly inspirational economics teacher at school called Peter Baker, who always believed that it wasn't simply about the ideas, but their application. And unemployment was above 3 million. Youth unemployment was very high. And there was a big debate about monetarism and how the economy worked. And I think from studying A-level at school onwards, I always wanted to be part of showing there's a different way to run the economy and to make economic policy. And that was in my mind all the way through undergraduate and graduate school.
And when you look at the arc of your story, you go off to Oxford and then Harvard, and then you go to the FT, and then you end up with Gordon Brown. I mean, it looks, with hindsight being a beautiful thing, like a perfectly designed path for a man who would end up in government. Were there moments that took you by surprise? Or I know you're a very ambitious man and you hate losing. Was there at some point where a plan emerged, or did it take you by surprise?
The thing which took me by surprise in the end was the desire to get elected, because I'm not sure that necessarily that was part of my plan when I was Oxford and Harvard at the FT. When I went to work with Gordon, it was to be an economic advisor. I then went to the Treasury. I was there for 8 years through all of those budgets and spending reviews. And in retrospect, that was my most influential period of my life, of my career. But I think I realized that I wasn't going to be satisfied simply being an advisor in the back room. I needed to have a go at trying to put myself out there and taking the heat myself.
Well, I was looking at it, and one of the curious things is, so you actually get a seat in 2005, And you do go into the kind of job you'd expect of you, which is, I think, your economic secretary to the Treasury. And then you're moved to be Minister for Children, Schools and Families. So that at the point when the most severe economic crisis, until that point, hits, in 2008 with the credit crunch and Alistair Darling and Gordon Brown having to basically save the global economy, you're outside the Treasury. So there are two questions. One, was that infuriating, or were you actually inside the Treasury anyway because they called you up and said, leave what you're doing, get in here, we need your help?
It was frustrating. And infuriating is not the right word, because being the cabinet minister in charge of schools and children's policy was hugely important and consuming and hard, and we had huge potential to do good things. But I had spent the previous 15 years of my life studying and working to on the economy, and then suddenly we were in the middle of the biggest crisis of our generation. I was on the outside, and it was frustrating. But I also very consciously stayed on the outside. I didn't.
You must have been waiting for the call, though. You must have been waiting for Gordon to. You and Gordon were, you know, I'm crossing my fingers. You were like that.
Yeah, but it was the other way around. The call came very many times from Gordon, and I basically said no. And I didn't think.
Why did you say no?
Well, so if you go back to the history, and the couple of, when Gordon becomes Prime Minister, for 3 days before his first reshuffle, he has said to me that he's decided he wants to make me the Chancellor and David Miliband Foreign Secretary. And I said, well, look, I think this is a big leap for me. There'll be lots of controversy. He said, it's what I'm going to do.
People would have been livid if a newly elected MP had been made Chancellor of the Exchequer, wouldn't they?
Well, we have one now called Rishi Sunak.
Well, that's true. But I'm talking back in 2005. But
then he was a new Prime Minister, and I'd had a long pedigree in the Treasury. So there'd been lots of speculation. I had done an interview saying that I wasn't expecting that because I wanted to dampen it. And then he then changed his mind. The truth is, there's a part of me which was feeling quite relieved, because it would have been a hell of a step up. But he said, choose what you want to do instead. And I chose education, children's schools and families, because that was something which I felt very passionate about. And that idea of bringing all policy for children and families into one place is something that I'd been very involved in the Treasury thinking about in the previous 6 months. But I know quite a lot about economic history and political economic history, and how hard it is to be Chancellor if you're being second-guessed, how vital the relationship between the Chancellor and the Prime Minister is, how often that becomes under pressure at times of tension and difficulty. Alistair Darling was the Chancellor. Gordon could have chosen me. He'd chosen Alistair. He was the Chancellor. Gordon, as Prime Minister, had to work out his relationship with the Chancellor. If I inserted myself into the middle of that relationship and became a second-guessing source of advice, you know, that was potentially very destabilising, and I had another job to do, which was to do children, schools and families. So, yes, it was frustrating. I sat it out and didn't. I mean, I'm not going to say I never spoke to Gordon about it, because every now and then I'd be in for something else and he would say, this is going on. But would I read the papers? Would I come to meetings? Would I become a economic policy player from education? I said I wouldn't do it.
Now, listen, should we move on to kebabs? I'm sure you're...
Sure.
You know, I'm sure you've got loads there, but you should have, in yours, you should have lamb sheesh, chicken sheesh and nadana, which is the minced lamb one.
The minced lamb ones are gorgeous.
You know, not all podcasts are like
this.
It's
incredible. I've got tavuk shish and shish kebab, and I've also got a couple of those amazing long green peppers, which however much you try and cook them at home, for some reason you can never quite get them to taste the same.
I think it's about having hot charcoal going all
gorgeous.
The time. Now listen, I'm not going to drag over the bones of those Labour governments, or even the time in opposition. I'm curious... How much of an impact it was on you when you lost? Oh, is that really good chicken? You were just holding that up with a look on your face.
It's meltingly good.
But that moment in 2015, when you lost the election, when you lost your seat, and just to complicate things, over on the other side, Yvette Cooper, your wife of many, many years, she doesn't lose her seat. What was it like? Was that a very odd night in your life?
Well, it's very memorable and very odd. It wasn't a hugely upsetting night. I don't think I felt upset until the evening of the next day. I mean, that night, at 10 o'clock, the exit poll dropped. And until that moment, I think everybody was expecting a hung parliament, that there wouldn't be a Conservative majority. And then the exit poll dropped at 10 o'clock. And suddenly the exit poll said Conservative majority. And that was kind of quite a big surprise. I mean, it turned out the exit poll understated the Tory majority. I went off to Leeds to do interviews with David Dimbleby down the line from the Leeds Count and all the broadcasters, which I thought were going to be easy because nobody would know what was going on at that point. I wasn't expecting an exit poll with a Conservative majority. But at that point, you're sort of pushing away the exit poll and saying it's far too early to tell. And David Dimbleby said, there's rumours that your seat may be at risk.
And you hadn't caught it?
Is, until that moment, it never occurred to me that I would lose my seat.
So were you on camera? I should know this, but were you on camera when your seat was, or did you get back to the count?
So what then happened was I went over the road. Suddenly I realised this is really tight. Maybe my seat's going to be tight. I don't really want to be on film while this is unfolding. I went across the road to a Premier Inn and basically sat alone until 7 a.m, watching the television. And I realised over those couple of hours, I might lose. And then I sat there and thought about what losing was going to mean for 7 hours and thought about what I would say. And I had a chance to think it through in that period. And I'm thinking, well, if David Cameron wins a majority, Ed Miliband's going to resign. There's going to be a leadership election. A bet will stand. Do I really want to be in Parliament for 5 years in her way? So actually, I was thinking, well, you know, I don't want to lose. But if I lose, okay. I mean, it will be a change, but you had to see the opportunity rather than the downside. It was only late in the day when I found out that my daughter, who at the time was doing GCSEs, she'd left without my result being public and then got halfway to school. She was doing that day a GCSE exam and then she realised she couldn't do the exam if she didn't know. So she came all the way back and waited until 8:15 it was announced and then went off to school again. And that my son, who at the time would have been 13, had sat all night with his granddad. That was a tough bit.
What did Yvette say?
I had spoken to Yvette a couple of times. She had her count, told her what I was going to say. She then came and met me at my agent's house in Morley, where we realised that we were going to be chased by the press, and I didn't really want to make statements beyond the speech. So we went back to his house, and there's about 20 people from my campaign team, and they were all talking to me like I'd died. And I remember it really well, kind of like, well, you know, you really made a contribution. It's been, you know, we're going to be sad to lose you. And I said, you know, this is like my funeral, and I'm still alive. And at that point, my agent's wife, who's brilliant, called Jane, she said, I know what we'll do. And she went to the kitchen, came back in with 20 small glasses and a bottle of Harvey's Bristol Cream. And she poured everybody at 9 a.m. a small glass of sherry. And they all toasted my demise. So we sort of had a sherry wake toast.
Hello, it's Ollie here. I'm the executive producer on Out to Lunch. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, one of the relationships I'm proudest of in my life is with my daughters. They're not quite the age to go for fancy lunches with celebs yet, but we do enjoy our family dinners together in relative harmony. You know, give us time, that they are still quite young. But this takes work, and it's a mistake to think that relationships have to be easy to be right. The best relationships come out of learning to live with each other and keeping our sense of humour, even when food is spilt all over the table or dinner's not to everyone's liking. It can be really tricky, but therapy can help you with those skills. You can work through parenting challenges, explore seeing eye to eye as a couple, and work through your relationship with yourself too. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's flexible and you can switch therapists at any time, as that's a relationship that needs to be the right fit too. Become your own soulmate, whether you're looking for one or not. Visit betterhelp.com/outtolunch today and get 10% off your first month.
Hey, Fidelity. What's it cost to invest with the Fidelity app?
Start with as little as $1 with no account fees or trade commissions on U.S. stocks and ETFs.
That's music to my ears.
I can only talk.
Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Zero account fees apply to retail brokerage accounts only. $0 commission applies to online U.S. equity trades and ETFs and retail Fidelity accounts. Sell order assessment fee not included. Some account types and securities excluded. Details at fidelity.com/commissions. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. Member NYSE, SIPC.
the post-politics, we're not completely post-politics because you're commentating on it and you make TV programs, you've been across Euroland and Trump's America. But whether the post-MP or parliamentary Ed Balls might quietly be a bit happier than the one who was actually inside politics.
I found coming out of government very hard because we'd been in government for 13 years, and suddenly there was all this time and I lost purpose. But I did, when I was shadow chancellor, so still in politics, start learning the piano, ran marathons, tried to sort of to spend more time doing other stuff. But and so today, compared to when I was in government, I'm fitter. I enjoy music more. I cook more. I can spend more time with the kids. I make more time for friends. I definitely feel as though I have a rounder, happier life. But politics is so purposeful. It's so hard. It's so important.
Should we move to dessert? You should.
Sure. Can I eat a bit more of my chicken?
Yeah, go on. I'm going to tell you what you've got. I'm going to try and pronounce it correctly. Is a Kaimakali Kunefe, which is shredded angel hair pastry with syrup, pistachio, mascarpone, all the good stuff.
Could do with a bit of vanilla ice cream, to be honest.
There was meant to be, but maybe it didn't turn up. You've done a lot of broadcasting,
yep.
Particularly the one I was watching was your adventures in Euroland. And you make this point that if you just dismiss these people who voted for populist governments, who voted for right-wing governments as awful and evil, then it's not really going to get you anywhere. And I found myself scratching my head at that because, you know, I'm Jewish. I'm a non-observant Jew, but I'm Jewish enough to be the recipient of vast anti-Semitic abuse. And I'm just wondering whether you can go too far with trying to be understanding in the political circumstances, and actually what's needed is just statements. In the episode in the Netherlands, where they're all dancing around as the Dutch traditional character Black Peter, you're horrified. And I wonder whether you really believe that or you were just trying to be open-minded.
I think you have to distinguish between listening to voters, citizens, understanding their concerns and trying to get to the heart of what they're worrying about, and then politicians who sometimes, for populist or quite dangerous, nasty ends, can manipulate voters to fit into, as you said, dangerous, evil, certainly immoral purposes. And there is a distinction there. I found going to have dinner with the AfD, the sort of new Nazi party politician in Germany, very difficult indeed, because the things he said and the things he stands for, the things he advocates are abhorrent. And the production team had said to me, would I be willing to go and have dinner with him? I said, I will. They said, would you be willing to cook dinner with him? Because we often try and get involved in activities to relax the contributors in order to get them to open up. And I said, look, I'm really sorry. I can't do that with this guy. I'm not going to go and join in with him in his kitchen. I will have dinner and I'll confront and challenge, but what I'm not going to do is sort of become his friend, because I can't do that. Whereas on the other hand, we went to a village in East Germany where they'd had the largest vote for their party in the elections. So you might think we're going to go and meet a whole bunch of sort of neo-Nazi, racist, anti-immigrant. And it was really hard to find that at all. We dug and dug. But what people said was, well, we've got a real problem in our village because the local school closed and all of our children now who used to go to school in the village now have to travel by bus 5 miles down the road. And in the election, we invited all the politicians to come and meet us. And the only candidate who came was from the AfD. And they said, look, we understand we need to make sure public services are available for every village and we'll try and sort this out. And so we voted for them. They felt as though mainstream politics wasn't listening and somebody turned up and took them seriously. Now, I'm not kind of don't want to be kind of naive about it, because there will be some of them who probably quite like some of the AfD policies. But it's very easy from the outside to say, well, if you voted AfD, you must be nasty, racist and really right wing. And actually it may be that you just feel as though things haven't been fair and the mainstream's not caring about you. And if you leave populism and those parties to hoover up that support. That's when you end up with societies taking dangerous directions. So you've got to understand that, listen to it, and try and counter it. That's the argument of the program.
The decisions. I mean, the obvious one, agreeing to do Strictly. Was that a long decision, or was that, oh yeah, no, I'm going to do that? Was it quick?
It didn't happen until well over a year after the election. And I'd gone through this kind of long period of thinking, well, what do I do now? And but there'd also been speculation about me going on Strictly the summer of 2015, because Yvette is on Woman's Hour. This is the only time she was asked this in the whole election. Will Ed Balls be the power behind the throne pulling your strings? And Yvette says, no. He's got much better things to do. Goodness knows, he'll probably be doing something like Strictly or something, she says. Which then means, by the time we got to the weekend, the Sun was writing Ed Balls to do Strictly. I mean, as far as I know, nobody had asked me to do Strictly, and I certainly wasn't going to do it. And they then came the following spring. An email arrived. I said to Yvette, Strictly have actually asked me to go on, and I'm going to say no. And she said, why? I said, well, because I can't go and do Strictly. I'm sort of... used to be a cabinet minister, and I've no idea what the hell I'm doing with my life, but surely it's something substantive and important. Just don't know what it is. It's not Strictly. And she said, why would you turn down the experience of a lifetime? And I then direct messaged on Twitter Jeremy Vine, and he said, it is by far the most life-affirming, positive thing I have ever done in my whole life. And if you got the chance, you should go and do it.
And did you find it to be the most life-affirming thing you'd done?
Oh, yeah. It was fabulous. It was hard physically, because we were doing 35 hours a week training. And as a politician, you perform, but you always play yourself.
A version of.
Or a version of yourself. Yeah. Whereas I had to learn to perform a role. And what I found was, if I was being me, I found it very constricting. But the moment I could decide to become, you know, the mask or a gladiator or a Gangnam dancer, I learned to put self aside and sort of, and I'd never done that kind of performance before, and I really enjoyed it. That moment of, and performing the waltz, it's, you just stand there and thinking, what am I doing? Welcome to my life. I want to be Chancellor of the Exchequer. And I think Jeremy was right. It's very kind of life-affirming. It's the only thing which my kind of kids have ever were actually quite proud of.
You've got BAFTA Moment of the Year for Dancing Gangnam Style. By the way, have you ever seen the video of me being taught to dance Gangnam Style by Psy?
No.
I interviewed Psy, and there is this video.
Did you?
Oh, yeah. And he's very clever, very bright man, very interesting. The whole thing is social commentary. It's not K-pop. It's a particular approach to, the Bessé-Bégé, the Knightsbridge of Seoul and their modes and manners. And then at the end, he teaches me, and I finally... Yeah, I get it. Oh, look, you're doing it now. I think that is a marvellous thing. On top of that, when did you take up the piano? Because that is the one thing we shared. Because the only communication we've had prior to this was me inviting you to one of my jazz gigs.
Which I'm really keen to come to.
Well, when the time cut, when the bars reopen and the venues reopen, we will make that happen. When did you take up the piano?
My kids, who were all learning piano, we just had an electronic piano at home, and they had a teacher who was fine. And then they got a new teacher who was teaching people on our road called Lola Perrin. And she was a brilliant teacher, and really, and they all loved her. And I thought, well, why aren't I learning to play the piano? And then I was then doing an interview with Patrick Winter at The Guardian, and I just mentioned this. And he said, I started recently. It's the best thing I've done. And what I did was, he said, I rented a piano from Markson's Pianos. And if you rent a piano, and then after a while you want to, you can then buy the piano and then rent rolls in.
Yeah, sure.
And so within 2 weeks of this moment, I had a piano teacher and I rented Markson's piano, and we were off.
And are you learning classical? Are you learning jazz? What are you learning?
I decided that I should go through the grade exams. And I've actually taken four.
So you turn up at those exam centres, and I'm assuming the rooms are full of children.
Lola basically teaches pretty much all children, but she had a couple of adults, and she'd never had an adult before who wanted to do the exams. But I thought that was a way to learn technique. And she said, do you want to kind of be part of my booking for grade one? And I said, I did. And she said, well, it will be up in Finsbury Town Hall. But the other thing you need to know is there'll be six of you and the other five are all aged under 10. And I said, well, fine, I'll come. Then the 5 days before, this was at the very end of the exam cycle, Ed Miliband's office announced he is making a speech on banking on the morning of my piano exam. And I say to my office, I'm really sorry, I've been practicing this for 9 months. I'm doing my exam. And they said, you're the shadow chancellor and the leader of the opposition is doing a speech on banking. You can't not go. And I said, well, I'm really sorry. It's my piano exam. And they said, this was an unacceptable explanation. Nobody will ever understand it. So then phone calls were made. And finally, the Associated Board, the day before, 2 days later, the final day of the cycle, said they would let me do the exam at their place just by the BBC, just above Oxford Circus. And I turn up with my piano teacher, and there was the only other people in the room was a mother and her 10-year-old. And I am so embarrassed, you know, that he's brought his mum and I've brought my piano teacher. And then as we're back, because you're allowed to go in the practice room for the exam, the mother leans over to me and says, excuse me, she said, do you mind me asking, are you taking the exam? And I said, yes. And she said, so am I. She said, my son's come along for moral support.
Oh, that's a brilliant
story.
And
then when I went into the exam, I'm not sure it was that one or a couple of years later, or the next one, there was a trainee examiner. So the examiner's sitting there being trained. So he's examining you, but he's got another examiner invigilating. And I have to do the whole play the pieces, the sight reading, you know,
Clap out the rhythm.
It's incredibly embarrassing. We get to the end and he says, very formally, he says, thank you, that is the end of your exam. And I said, I've got to say, much more stressful than the House of Commons. And he looked up at me with this fear in his eyes, because obviously he's not allowed to have any personal engagement with the examinee, even if it's the Shadow Chancellor's Exchequer. So he looked at me and went, put his head down and carried on writing, and I walked out feeling a bit of a prick.
I think we should, you know, when all this is over, we get around a piano and we show each other a few tunes.
If you would teach me a little bit of simple jazz piano playing, I would love it.
It's a deal. Definitely a deal. Ed Balls, thank you very much for staying in for lunch with me. It's been fascinating and an absolute joy in every single way.
I've enjoyed it very much. I'm going to go and get all the others down and see if they fancy a bit of Turkish late lunch.
I'm glad to know Ed and the family will be eating lunchtime Turkish for the rest of the week. And if you live in London and you're interested in trying what we ate for yourself, Ed's lunch came from a stalwart of the Turkish restaurant community on London's Green Lanes, Daya Bekir, via Deliveroo. And mine came from Saray, that's S-A-R-A-Y, on Norwood Road in South London. They deliver direct from their website, which is sarayhernhill, all one word, .co.uk. If that wasn't enough, you can find a heap more episodes wherever you get your podcasts. And if you could give us, a 5-star review and share us, we'd be almost embarrassingly grateful. Out to Lunch is a Something Else and Jay Rayner production. The music was written, arranged and performed by me, Jay Rayner, and Robert Rickenberg. The mix engineer was Josh Gibbs. The assistant producer was Jemima Rathbone. The producers are Selena Ream and Hannah Newton. And the executive producer is Darby Doris. Additional production is from Steve Ackerman. Next time, I'll be in for lunch with the BAFTA-nominated actress famous for her roles in Wild Rose, Chernobyl and Beast. It's Jessie Buckley. What was it like being on set with Julie Walters?
But she's really, like, down to earth and she's just there with you, you know. There's no, like, airs or graces or anything, and very open and wants to make each scene as alive as possible, but also up for a laugh and a cup of tea and a packet of crisps, which is the most important thing on a set.